Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Knights Magica by B.R. Kingsolver. Narrated by Madeline Dower. Chapter 1. I survived. That was the thought that ran through my mind as I stood in front of the floor-length mirror in my temporary bedroom in Sam's apartment over the bar. I needed to hold on to that. Survival was the important thing. The thing I had been clinging to, fighting for, ever since I stepped off the bus in Westport. The image in front of me looked a lot better than what Agatha the healer had confronted 3 days before. At least, that's what she told me. I didn't know. I had been asleep for those 3 days. I expected the bruising to be worse, and Agatha said it had been before she began treating me. Potions and salves, magical healing and antibiotics. Many parts of my body still hurt to move or touch. At least she had the infections under control. She told me that a surgeon might be able to smooth out the worst burns with skin grafts, but no surgery or magic could restore feeling where nerves were damaged so badly. Perhaps a fey healer might be able to do more, but the fey had left the world above. Most of the damage was superficial, and I didn't care about the cosmetics. The scars would remind me of the mistakes I had made that led to my capture, of the cruelty my captors were capable of, and of the moral depravity of those who cared for power above all else. I had been missing, held captive by the Knights Magica, for 30 days. Held in total darkness, fed irregularly, but no more than once a day, with barely enough water to maintain life, I had lost 30 pounds. The scorpion had been captured, beaten and tortured, subjected to exorcism and psychological manipulation, promised paradise and repeatedly given a sample of hell. But she lived. Payment was due. I didn't consider for even an instant turning the other cheek. Michaela, who was captured with me, had killed one of our tormentors when she escaped. Sam told me that the knights treated her worse than they did me, but since a Dampier didn't have magic, they were careless with her. Michaela was far more bloody-minded than I was, and she made them pay. Staring at the scarecrow in the mirror, I knew the knights hadn't paid enough. I owed them a huge payment for Michaela, too. Agatha came twice a day. The first morning that I was awake, I watched as she treated my injuries. The bruising was fading, but my breasts and ribs were still tender. The burns from a curling iron had become infected. Those areas were numb, and I could feel when they were touched, but they didn't hurt. Hesitantly, she asked, "There are other, different burns." "Electrical burns, a cattle prod," I answered, and saw shock in her eyes. "Dear goddess," she whispered, "inhuman." I nodded. "Savages. They say their religion is about love and peace. He shall answer to his god, but first he'll answer to me." Her eyes widened. "Take care for your soul." With a shake of my head, I said, "I damned my soul long ago. What I do from this point forward is about redemption. If I burn in hell because of fighting for others, for shouldering their sins, so be it. My soul is black, Agatha. The best I can do is shade it with a little gray." Agatha was at least 100 years old and a large woman, a few inches taller than I was, and in my current state, far stronger. She grabbed me by the upper arms, shook me a little until I met her eyes, and said, "Your soul is not beyond redemption. Fighting against the dark is not evil. Taking pleasure in death and destruction is evil. As long as you don't go down that path, as long as you embrace the light and do things for the right reasons, your soul belongs to you and the goddess. You know right and wrong. There are lines, and you know them. Don't wallow in self-pity, and don't try to bullshit those who see you for what you are." Her face became fierce. "An angel of retribution you are not. Don't flatter yourself. You're just a young girl with a lot of power who has been hurt. And I don't give a damn how many times you've been hurt or how badly. That doesn't give you the right to hurt others simply for the twisted pleasure of inflicting pain." Her face relaxed, and she pulled me into a hug. "But there's nothing wrong with preventing the savages from hurting someone else, with protecting the innocent, with standing for the light. Something inside of you is strong and fierce, and that is good. Right and wrong, child. Don't lose track of them, and don't mistake what makes you feel powerful with the feeling you get when you've done something good." Tears spilled down my cheeks. "It's so hard sometimes," I sobbed. "Sometimes I just want to give up, but I don't know how." "And God is willing you never will. Some of us are given a harder path to follow. Your path is difficult, but the goddess never gives us more than we can shoulder. The only way you can lose is to give in to the dark. That is the easy way, to become one of the savages." A jolt of magic flowed from her into me. "Sleep, child. Sleep and heal." The world went dark. When I woke next, I was alone. The light coming through the windows told me it was mid-morning, and some saint had left breakfast, still warm, on the table in the apartment's dining room. I poured coffee and orange juice, then opened the folded piece of paper next to the plate. The handwriting was Sam's.
"Ariel wants to see you. Let me know if you're ready for him."
My heart jumped in my chest. Then, as I thought of him touching me, of any male touching me, a feeling of revulsion flowed through me. My skin crawled, I shivered, and I panicked. I almost vomited, but choked it down. Oriel, my lover, had rescued me. On the ride from the monastery where I was kept captive to Rosie's, he held me close against his body. The first human warmth I'd had in 30 days. All the places he had touched me. All the places my body had met his. The knights wanted my soul. What did Oriel want? Only weeks before, I wanted him, needed him. His touch, his smell, him deep inside me, as much as I needed oxygen. I had never wanted a man before I met him, never desired or craved a man before. But now, the thought of his touch made me almost physically ill. My stomach churned and nausea almost overwhelmed me. By all the gods, had the knights penetrated that deeply into my mind? Had they destroyed the one part of me that the Illuminati had never been able to take? That thought alone made me nauseous. I had taken men and women to bed and left them dead without the least remorse or concern. My body was just another tool. Oriel had changed the way I felt about sex, about men, about people. As profoundly as Lizzie, Jolene, Michaela, and Sam had done, but in a different way. I got up from the table and went into the bedroom. Staring at my image in the mirror, I swore that if the knights had destroyed my one chance at love, at normal feelings toward another human being, I would burn their entire world to ash. Then I went back to my breakfast and wrote a single word on Sam's note. Yes. I had to be ready for Oriel, or the knights had won. After breakfast, I pushed the paper under the door and went back to bed. Sometime, I wasn't sure when, a familiar presence crawled into my bed and wrapped his arms around me. Oriel pulled me close and held me. He asked nothing of me that night, or the next, just held me. When I woke in the morning and turned to look him in the eyes, he gently kissed me, and I knew that I was loved, and that made me smile. We lay there together, stroking each other and kissing and smiling. It wasn't sexual, but it was the most intimate time I had ever spent with anyone. Eventually, we got up and took a shower. Afterward, as I stood in front of the mirror combing out my hair, he came up behind me and clasped a chain around my neck. The star ruby and the silver filigree looked just like the necklace he had given me before. It even had the charm Jolene had made. Is this new?
No. When you went missing, Jolene tracked her charm, and we found the knight who kidnapped you. Unfortunately, he didn't know where you were taken after he delivered you and Michaela Gallagher to Seneschal Bonato.
And he gave you my pendant? Oriel's grin was frightening.
Not exactly. I found it when I searched his body.
Chapter 2. My condition gradually improved. A combination of decent food, magical treatments, and antibiotics, along with fresh air and exercise, worked wonders. After a week, Agatha told me that she could do no more for me, and I talked Sam and Oriel into moving me back into my apartment. I had missed the beginning of spring and my birthday while enjoying the night's hospitality. I came home to discover the trees between my apartment and the jogging path by the stream, celebrating spring with a wonderful display of white flowers. I spoke over the phone with Michaela, then made plans for Oriel to drive me out to her estate the following week. She also insisted on sending David Cunningham and two shifters over to keep an eye on my place during the daytime, and three vampires to keep watch at night. And since Oriel was already playing my shadow 24 hours a day, I had a constant entourage any time I left the apartment. I had to admit, it was comforting to know I wasn't going to be surprised by a bunch of crazy nights when I went out for a walk or took a trip to the grocery store. As I recovered my strength, I allowed myself to think about the ordeal I had undergone. Of my three tormentors, Scarlatti, who in some ways was the most terrifying of the bunch, had been taken care of by Michaela. And although I swore that next time I faced Bonato, I would make sure he was dead, thoughts of Olivetti sent me into an absolute red rage. I realized that I had never hated anyone before, but he had won the honor. Oriel was doing something on my computer while I sat on the balcony reading a funny romance novel. Since becoming involved in my own romance, I found that I enjoyed such novels even more than I had before, especially the ones that didn't take themselves too seriously. One of the things Oriel was teaching me was how to laugh at myself, at him, at us. It was a lot more fun when we were laughing. "Oriel," I said in my best come-hither flirty voice at the end of my first week at home, "please do me a favor." He chuckled.
"Anything, my love. Do you wish me to pull down the moon and set it in a bracelet for you?"
"Next week, perhaps. But first, I need to know Marshal Olivetti's schedule, his movements." Oriel lifted an eyebrow.
"Getting to him would be almost impossible without an army. He travels everywhere with a convoy."
"I'm not planning on using conventional means," I said. "I have a couple of ideas, one of which would require your skills as a smith and those Illuminati spells. But I also have an idea that doesn't require any weapons at all, just the right setting for a unique ambush." He got up from his chair and joined me on the balcony, a predatory grin on his face.
"Tell me more."
We drove out to Killarney Village that afternoon and had an early dinner in a cozy little cafe run by a couple of witches. Their fae lovers had retreated into the mound, but the cafe stayed open. "What else are we supposed to do?" one of the owners asked me. "Move into the city and open a new cafe for the knights?" "We thought about it," the other witch said with a wink. "How many of them could we poison before they caught on?" The cuisine was what they called Asian Fae Fusion, and it was great. Oriel ordered for me, curried acorns with honeycomb tempura and rowanberry custard for dessert. After dinner, we went over to his place and he fired up his forge. As we waited for it to heat, he told me that a non-magical forge would take days to reach the necessary temperature to melt the alloys he used, but his magical forge took only a couple of hours.
In the old days, a human blacksmith never let his forge go cold, Auriel said. A hot forge was handed down through generations.
While we waited, he gathered the metals he would use and set up the molds for the rough casts. The forge wasn't the only magical thing about his work. I watched him carve a dozen molds in less than an hour and knew a human blacksmith would have taken a day to carve each one. When his metal was melted and ready to pour into the molds, I drew the runes and chanted the incantations gleaned from the secret History of the Illuminati book. 4 hours after we started work, we drove back to Westport with 48 possible new weapons to use against the Knights Magica. Auriel spent the next week following Marshal Olivetti around while one of his fey buddies stalked Seneschal Bonato. I drove out to the country club every evening and worked out. Some of that was work with the sword, but most was spent in the club's gym, building muscles that had atrophied during my confinement. I also worked with my new bright idea, practicing with the crossbow that Gil Prudhomme, the club's swordmaster, had loaned me. The bolts Auriel cast were uncannily accurate, and when Gilles weighed them, they were within a gram of each other, even though they were cast in 12 different molds. I was shooting them at a target 100 yards away when Michaela said from behind me, "Why not have the smith cast spelled bullets?" She startled me, sending my heart into my throat. I still wasn't used to the silence of supernaturals sneaking up on me. "I'm concerned with the interaction between magic and the pyrochemical effects of gunpowder," I replied as I turned toward her. "Besides, it takes a lot of time to make each projectile, and crossbow bolts are reusable." She nodded.
"You're looking well, if a little thin and pale."
It was the first time we had seen each other since the day we were taken. "I might say the same about you, except you just look a little more like a supermodel rather than a movie star." Michaela licked her lips.
"Yeah, every man's dream. A tall, skinny chick with big boobs. God, Aaron, I've never felt so fragile in my life."
"Sam said you'd been tortured, Olivetti."
She nodded. "He was the worst. Bonato likes to hit women, but Olivetti is a sadistic monster."
"I'm going to take the bastard out. Soon.
Can I watch?"
"I'll try to arrange it."
"So, these crossbow bolts are like your sword? They'll pass through a personal shield?"
she asked, picking up one of the bolts I had laid out on a small table in front of me. "So I hope. The same spells went into their making, but until I try one on a shielded mage, I won't know if they work."
"I'll happily volunteer a few nights," she said.
"The difficulty is in setting up a controlled experiment," I said. "Simply ambushing some of them won't really answer all my questions." Michaela laughed.
"A magic user preaching the scientific method. That has to take the cake."
"Au contraire, mon ami. Witches are the most careful experimenters in the world. Most human scientists aren't playing with forces that will leave smoking craters where they're standing. We isolate young mages when they first come into their power because they tend to blow things up, light things on fire, or short things out. I knew an aeromancer who started a Force 3 tornado inside a building." She shook her head.
"I hadn't really thought about it. With new vampires, we have to manage their bloodlust, but that's pretty straightforward. It just takes a couple of years."
"Yeah, no big deal, unless you're one of the humans who gets drained. Back to the crossbow bolts," I said. "If they work, we can arm people who aren't trained to use a sword against the knights."
"Yeah, that would be useful. Speaking of which, tell your boyfriend that I'll pay him whatever he asks for one of his swords. I'm not letting those motherfuckers touch me again."
I nodded. "I'll tell him. A friend of mine carries a crossbow pistol with wooden bolts for vamps. If these work, you might look into that." After a week of tailing Olivetti, Auriel sat down with me and a map of Westport. The best thing about having a fae do the shadowing is, if I asked any questions, Auriel simply projected an illusion of the scene from memory.
"Like I told you, he goes everywhere with a security force," Auriel said. 5 of those large SUVs, 2 ahead and 2 behind the one he's riding in. All of the knights are shielded. They've been ambushed too many times. Most of them don't go out in public anymore unless they're shielded.
And the knights in his entourage are older, more experienced, I said. Not like the fools they first assigned here.
Yes, these are more skilled, harder to hunt.
Among my objectives was to kill Olivetti without leaving any witnesses or any forensic evidence that might point to me or Michaela. That meant magic, and also meant I had to get close to him. On the other hand, I wanted it plainly evident that his death was attributable to either magic or the wrath of God. I want you to take me to these three places, I said, pointing to the map. I need to see if they will work for what I have in mind. Oriel shook his head and pointed to a spot on the map.
This is the only place that might make a good ambush spot.
It wasn't one of the places I had identified. Okay, we'll take a look at that one, too, I said. Can we go now? I want to check things out before we worry about how I'm going to kill Olivetti. The first place he took me was on the drive up to the monastery. About halfway between the knight's headquarters and the main road, the driveway made a hairpin curve. The large SUVs had to slow to around 15 miles per hour at that point. We parked downhill and climbed up to a place where we could see the hairpin from above. 2 months before, I would have practically sprinted up that hill, but the climb that day told me how much I had lost and how much I still had to go in rebuilding my strength. It took me 40 minutes, with frequent rests, and I was sweating and my legs were shaking by the time we reached our vantage point.
"See what I mean?" Oriel asked, after he decided I wasn't going to pass out. "You can see the cars from here, but the angle for a shot is lousy. All you can see are the tops of the cars. Maybe a pyromancer could get him with a fireball."
From my perspective, the problem was distance. I was too high above the road, and there weren't any large rocks. My magic's range was far more limited than that of most mages. The other places weren't any better. Either I couldn't get close enough to use my magic, or there were too many potential witnesses, or there was a possibility of innocent bystanders being caught in the attempt. That left my last choice.
The parking lot of St. Tobias?
Both Michaela and Oriel had the same reaction. After the attack we staged as a distraction to hide my burglary, the church had erected a wall around the parking lot of the largest Universalist church in the city. Once Olivetti and his escort entered the lot, they were out of sight of any witnesses except the knights. Disguising Michaela and me didn't require much except some clothes from Goodwill, and Oriel glamored himself in a priest's robes. We entered the church through the front door and exited through a side door to the parking lot. Punctual as he always was, Olivetti and his entourage pulled into the lot 5 minutes later. One of the knights hopped out of the car Olivetti was riding in and opened the door for his marshal. Olivetti climbed out and walked toward the door, where I was waiting. I went forward to meet him. "Marshal Olivetti, what a pleasant surprise," I said. I was hoping that we would get the chance to renew our acquaintance. He stopped, staring at me with apparent loathing in his expression. His attention and that of his men focused exclusively on me, and no one except his driver, who was still in the car, seemed to notice that his SUV lifted 25 feet in the air and drifted toward me. It was a cloudy day, and so it didn't even cast a shadow when it passed above Olivetti. I stopped holding it up with leyline energy, and it dropped. The noise when it hit the pavement was a lot louder than I expected. A personal shield protected a mage from bullets, knives, magical fireballs, and a number of other attacks. Standing in front of a moving train was something my trainers discouraged. A personal shield was never a good defense against having 6,000 pounds of steel drop on a person. I picked up another of the SUVs and dropped it in the same spot, then a third. By that time, the knights in the remaining two vehicles had abandoned them, but I added them to the pile anyway. It sounded like a chain reaction crash on the freeway. No one made any moves to stop me when I turned and walked back inside the church. Michaela and Oriel followed me out the front door. We shed our disguises around the corner, then went to a cafe a little ways down the street and had breakfast while watching the ensuing excitement.
"I didn't realize you could pick up something that large," Michaela said.
I shrugged. Weight really doesn't have anything to do with it. The magic is doing the lifting. It's basically dependent on how much magical energy I can pull. But I can't wield magic more than about 30 or 40 feet away from me, whether lifting a car or a pea. What I really wanted to do was drop a big rock on him, but he never goes any place where that might be possible.
"Could you lift a building?"
Oriel asked. "Possibly, if it didn't have a foundation. I mean, a trailer house wouldn't be a problem. But how do I differentiate a concrete foundation from the earth it's buried in? I can't lift the world." He nodded toward the church.
"Could you destroy that church?"
"If no one stopped me. I could batter the walls with leyline magic until they cracked, or I could hurl large objects at it. Once there's a breach, I could knock it down, but it would take some time. Easier to use dynamite. But my training included an understanding of architecture toward doing just that, a living siege engine."
"What about a circle?" Michaela asked. "Isn't there something about 13 witches combining their power?"
"Oh, yeah. Witches or mages. You can do a circle with any number, but 13 is considered the optimal number. Everyone pulls power and directs it through the circle to the leader, who channels the power into whatever the group is trying to do. The power that can be channeled that way is more than addictive. A circle of 13 strong mages is how they created Stonehenge."
"And if such a circle tried to knock down the church?"
Oriel prompted. "Piece of cake. We could probably destroy it in a few minutes. There are always weak spots, and those would collapse first." The look Michaela and Oriel exchanged told me that I had given them an idea. Chapter 3. Even though Rosie O'Grady's Bar and Grill was warded against the corruption that occasionally hit the ley lines, the mages inside could still feel it when the lines blew up. Shortly after returning to work, I was tending bar when the ley lines went crazy. 5 minutes later, half a dozen knights in uniform swaggered through the door. They carried their swords and had pistols holstered at their hips. "Oh, shit," was my first reaction. "Hey, you can't come in here armed," I called out while pulling leyline magic and casting my personal shield. Their leader walked up to the bar, and the other five fanned out in front of the entrance.
"I am Boris Yovanovich," he said, "Chevalier of the Knights Magica."
"I don't care if you're the prelate himself. You need to leave your weapons outside. House rules, besides the fact that carrying weapons into a bar is against the law."
"We answer to a higher authority. I wish to speak with Samuel O'Grady." Higher authority, my ass. I bit my tongue and reached under the counter for the magic-infused baseball bat that served as the bar's bouncer.
"Sam's not here. You'll need to come back tomorrow during the daytime, unarmed." He sneered at me.
"We'll just look around."
"No, you won't. You'll leave and come back only after you've divested yourselves of your weapons." Jovanovich put his hand on his sword and started to draw it. He cleared a foot of blade from its scabbard when I swung the bat and broke his arm. That surprised me. I couldn't believe he was arrogant enough that he hadn't bothered to shield himself. I leaped over the bar and grabbed him by the throat. Lifting him into the air, with his feet dragging on the floor, I marched toward his men. Three of them stared at the two of us with shocked expressions. The other two reacted by reaching for their swords. I slammed Jovanovich into one of the sword wielders while swinging the bat at the other one. I hit the sword, knocking it out of his hand, and it clattered to the floor. Liam, my partner behind the bar, fired a burst of leyline energy that sent the knight flying into a wall. "Jenny, call the cops!" I shouted. A dozen of my customers enthusiastically assisted in restraining the knights until the police arrived.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?